Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 188 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, the first instalment of our new Location and the Writers series, Kathleen Jones takes us to a hill farm in Cumbria, Catherine O'Flynn takes us behind the facade at a suburban shopping centre, and Doug Johnston takes us to the literary city of Edinburgh. First, Kathleen Jones takes us to a Cumbrian hill farm.
I'm standing on a hillside in the Lake District, looking at one of the most beautiful views in England. Behind me is the bulk of Skiddaw, the third highest mountain, and in front of me I can see the Solway Estuary flashing blue and grey in the sun. If I turn to the right, I can clearly see the ragged outline of the Cheviots, marking the Scottish border. Below me is the farm where I grew up, though from this angle it's hidden by the garth of trees that provides shelter from the weather. The word garth is Old Norse, a reminder that 1,000 years ago there were a lot of Vikings here, and they left their mark on the landscape. I grew up speaking a dialect that Melvyn Bragg once remarked was better understood in Oslo than in London. The farm's surrounded by rush-infested boggy fields, only marked out from the fell side by crumbling stone walls. In my father's time, these fields were hay meadows, but now they're rapidly being reclaimed by the wild. This is marginal land, feral ground that can never be completely tamed. It's exposed, very Wuthering Heights, and I used to pretend I was Emily Bronte, wandering the moors dreaming of Heathcliff. Everything I wrote back then was very gothic. I can remember, as a child, climbing up here to watch the sun set in the sea, lying in the tufted brown grass and listening to the curlews and the skylarks and the cries of sheep. Today, it's almost completely silent, except for the trickle of a beck. You're never far from water in the Lake District. Once you couldn't walk over this ground in spring without stepping on a curlew's nest or startling an indignant lark. I find the silence rather sad. But what there is here is space. The sky seems to go on forever. As a child, I filled this space with imaginary adventures, stories and poems, and invented characters to share them with. I was never lonely, but definitely solitary. It was an isolated existence. It's 5 miles to the nearest village, and there are no buses, and my father didn't own a car, so we walked. School meant a mile down the fell track to the main road, where a taxi picked me up to take me to the village, where I caught the school bus to the nearest town. In winter, this journey took about 1.5 hours each way, in darkness. Now I'm hoping to squelch down that track to the farmhouse, where the present owner has agreed to let me wander round. When my father eventually lost his struggle with the elements and the bank, the land was taken by a neighbouring farmer, and the house sold as a holiday cottage to a family from London. This often happens in the Lake District. We were just lucky that the house was bought by a member of the Kirwan family, who have connections with the Wordsworths. From the outside, the farm looks very much as it always did. The lime-washed walls are still showing the impact of the weather. The windows are outlined in the traditional Lake District black paint, and the doors of the barns and byres are painted red. It's built in a square round a cobbled yard with its back to the prevailing wind. Shelter's always been more important here than a nice view. For me, coming back, the place is full of stories. Here's the byre where I learnt to milk a cow by hand, the feed store where I was attacked by one of the sheepdogs when I was 12, and then the barn where a Neolithic stone axe was found embedded in the cobbled floor. It was also the scene of some childhood epics. My cousins and I used to write plays in the summer holidays and then perform them for our parents, using the hayloft as a stage. We made scenery out of old sheets, and our parents sat on the hay bales. I've still got some of the handwritten programmes we made for what we called our Barn Theatre Productions. Inside the front door of the house, I'm now standing in a narrow entrance passage where one of our shire horses once tried to come into the house and got stuck. This is an episode that went down in family history. On my right is the living room with flagged floors. Very dark, the walls are about a metre thick, the windows very small, and the ceiling really low. This isn't a house for tall people. There's a kind of sadness about coming back to a place where you once lived. It's all very familiar, and at the same time also quite alien. Someone else's furniture, someone else's decoration, and very little left of what you once had. The old range that my mother used to bake cakes on has gone and been replaced by a wood-burning stove. Without electricity for much of our lives here, because of the remoteness of the location, the fire in the range boiled kettles for hot water and cooked all our food. It also kept us warm, winter and summer. This room was also the social centre of the house. There's a parlour on the other side, but that was rarely ever used, so this was where friends and neighbours were entertained. I used to sit on the hearth and listen to them talking. All the old stories about people who'd once lived here. The woman whose ghost was supposed to haunt the road after her children had been lost in a blizzard coming home from school. And another neighbour who was driven mad by the isolation. There were also tales of escaped slaves imported into Cumbria from the West Indies, along with the rum and the brown sugar that's become part of Cumbrian cuisine. But not all the stories were sad. One of our neighbours would tell the tale of sleeping off a night in the pub in someone's barn and being woken up as the farmer hoisted the bales onto a trailer to take to the fields. And there was a lot of gossip, not meant for children's ears. Who was having affairs with whom? Who was having problems with money? Stories were handed on like heirlooms, and I stored them all up. I've now moved into what was called the back kitchen, a large farmhouse scullery with flagged floors and a big Belfast sink. In my parents' day, there was a wash copper in the corner and a huge mangle standing against the wall. Mangling the washing was one of my jobs, and I was terrified of catching my fingers in the rollers as I fed the sheets and the shirts into it. It was freezing here in winter, and I still shiver when I think about it. But when I came to write about the women of the Wordsworth family, Mary and Dorothy, and the privations of Dub Cottage, I had some first-hand experience that helped me to understand their lives. There's also a bathroom now, which is a wonderful addition. When I was growing up, having to bathe in a tin bath in front of the fire was a humiliation, and going to the outdoor earth closet on a winter's night was the stuff of nightmares. The friends I brought home from school to spend the weekend were utterly shocked. Upstairs, there are four rooms. There's an attic room at the top of the stairs, which we always thought contained a boggle, which is a kind of Cumbrian evil spirit. And then there's the big room my parents slept in, and a smaller one next door for my little brother. And then mine. I was given the room over the living room, where the chimney from the range downstairs generated a bit of heat, and this was where I first started to write, sitting up in bed by candlelight, wrapped in a blanket. Some of those first scribblings were even published. I wrote witty scraps for teenage magazines, poems, items for the local papers, even the Farmers Weekly. I wanted desperately to be a writer, but I didn't know how you became one. It wasn't a career they prepared you for at school. But it was inevitable that whatever I was going to do with my life involved leaving the farm. Unless you worked on the land, there were very few jobs up here. So I plotted my escape, setting my sights on London, because that was where you went to become a writer, or so I believed. I didn't realise then that I already was, or that my roots were so deeply embedded in this house that I'd always feel an exile anywhere else. A place like this gets into your bones and stays there. However far you go, or how much time has elapsed, I'm always going to be what it made me.
That was Kathleen Jones. Next, here's Catherine O'Flynn.
Inspiration isn't always welcome. Back in the 1990s, I worked in what we used to call a record shop. I'm not sure what we call them nowadays. I moved from branch to branch in my slow but still inexplicable rise up the retail ladder until I reached my career peak, assistant manager of the Maryhill branch. Maryhill is a shopping centre in the geographically nebulous part of the West Midlands, known as the Black Country. I'd visited plenty of shopping centres in my life. I'd even worked in ones before, but Maryhill, or Maryhell as it's inevitably known, was different in both its scale and its impact upon me. I have that shopping centre to thank for becoming a novelist. It's nice to have something tangible to show for the time I spent there, as I never managed to complete my NVQ in retail. Perhaps inspiration isn't really the right word. It seems to both underestimate and oversimplify the reality. Maryhill didn't really serve as an inspiration to me. It served more as a lens, bringing into sharp focus things that had previously been indistinct or invisible. Inconveniently, this was accompanied by the urgent need to set these things down on paper. I really wasn't thrilled or excited about this compulsion at the time. I wasn't an aspiring author looking for inspiration. I was a worn-out retail worker who just wanted to get home each evening, drink wine exclusively from the 3 for £10 selection at my local off-licence, and watch videos of Seinfeld. But I couldn't escape the centre. It followed me home and kept me up late filling notebooks. There's something about the cracked paving stones and steady drizzle of a traditional British high street that grounds us in our location. But shopping malls can be curiously invisible to their visitors. The covered walkways of Maryhill provided frictionless, polished surfaces for shoppers to glide along, enticing them to look but not see. With its fractured topography, reflective surfaces and theatrical lighting, Maryhill seemed to mesmerise those who crossed its threshold. Seeming somehow both sedated and frenzied, the shoppers at Maryhill came like wave after wave of a zombie army, rolling ever onwards to the next TV-advertised CD compilation. Perhaps I wouldn't have noticed how strange customers were en masse if I, as a member of staff, hadn't been kept so carefully separated from them. Discreetly hidden in the walls, like secret panels, were doorways for workers to get to and from their designated entrances. The tangled service corridors behind the doors stretched for miles like a distorted shadow of the main mall. It was easy to get lost in them, and I frequently did, finding myself trapped in dead ends or emerging into vast waste processing areas by mistake. I'd always loved Mervyn Peake's Gormenghast books, and when I started working at Maryhill, I was struck by the parallels between these two very different but equally labyrinthine worlds. The corridors of the centre were characterised by bare breeze block walls, stripped fluorescent lighting and industrial-sized rodent traps. As members of staff, we received regular warnings not to use the customer toilets, seating areas or car parks. We were to be visible only when directly facilitating a sale. The rest of the time, we were ghosts. The service corridors served exactly the same purpose as the tunnels sometimes found on historic great estates, allowing ground staff to reach the gardens without interrupting the vistas of the aristocracy. As well as seeing backstage, I also got to see the mall when it was closed. There's something eerie about any busy place out of hours. The most banal locations can become menacing by night. By day, it may be a school corridor or an open plan office, but go back after dark and you find yourself on a Kubrick film set. With the piped music turned off, the escalator still and the windows shuttered, Maryhill was predictably spooky before and after closing. But added to this, there was always the clammy awareness of being watched. I'd been dimly conscious of security cameras as a shopper. I'd been especially conscious of them during a brief teenage foray into shoplifting, scented erasers on both occasions. But I never felt their gaze as sharply as I did once I started working at Maryhill. It was only there that I realised the true extent of everyday surveillance. As well as the centre's private security force, each shop also employed its own guards and store detectives. Each of these discreet teams had their own system of cameras and monitors. In the daytime, bored security guards used the cameras to spy on shoplifters, spy on staff, and ogle women. Out of hours, though, locking up the shop on my own in a seemingly empty centre, I'd wonder who was watching me and why. I'd wonder what the camera saw in the centre in the dead of night. Because Merry Hill always felt haunted to me. By who, I'm not sure. Maybe those who had spent their lives working there but were now excluded. Before it was a shopping mall, Merryhill had been a steelworks. When the foundry closed in 1982, the local economy shut down with it. The area was designated an enterprise zone to encourage other manufacturers back, but instead developers saw an opportunity to open a shopping centre. The local population, with its high unemployment rates and low household incomes, was never the target audience for the centre. A glittering palace of branded delights, the gaze of Merryhill was always fixed firmly on the horizon and the more affluent populations within a few miles radius. Driving to work there each day was like driving to the epicentre of some unnatural disaster. As I got closer, the number of empty shops steadily increased until it seemed that entire high streets were boarded up. I used to wonder what it must be like to live in those areas, right under the ramparts, and yet somehow invisible. All this, the fears, the questions, the crazed scribblings in notebooks, eventually turned into my first novel, What Was Lost. Following publication, something strange happened. I began to be seen as a critic of consumer culture. I'd written a dark story set in a shopping centre. I was revealing something rotten at the heart of the retail experience. Sometimes journalists would ring to talk to me about it. I'd answer the phone and say, "It's not a good time to talk, I'm out at the shops." And they'd laugh. There I was, humorously skewering contemporary society again. No, I'd say, "Really, I'm in the bullring shopping." It wasn't something A.S. Byatt ever said when they rang her. The truth is that it was never my intention to condemn shopping centres or those who milled aimlessly around them. I always saw myself as one of that crowd. My hope was only ever to try and capture the essence of these places that despite, or perhaps because of their size and ubiquity, somehow escaped or beguiled our gaze. Merryhill was a turning point for me. It was where I realised that place was the key to seeing through the fog. This has continued to be the case with my subsequent novels. Certain places, elderly residential homes, Spanish ghost towns, allow a reframing of everything around me. They defamiliarise and make the invisible visible. And whenever I'm lucky enough to find myself somewhere that gives me that kind of glimpse, I feel I have to write, to send dispatches back from the other side of the fog.
That was Catherine O'Flynn. Finally, here's Doug Johnston.
For a long time, I was scared to write about Edinburgh. I don't think it was ever a conscious decision, but looking back over my work now, it's clear that my subconscious was doing its best to make me steer clear of the city in my fiction. The Scottish capital is such a well-mapped place with respect to literature that I'm sure in the back of my mind I was suffering from a serious inferiority complex. What could little old me add to what so many great writers had already said about Edinburgh? But over the years, my relationship with the place that is now my home has changed, as any relationship does, and that has definitely been reflected in my writing. Let's rewind a little. In 1988, I moved to the city to study physics at the University of Edinburgh. I had grown up in Arbroath, a small fishing town on the northeast coast of Scotland, a place famous for smoked fish and an abbey. I was the classic, clichéd small-town boy, a naive hayseed overwhelmed by the hustle and bustle of the big city. I had only ever visited briefly a handful of times before that, despite it only being a couple of hours by road or rail. To me, Dundee was the big smoke, and Edinburgh seemed almost like a mythical place, somewhere out beyond the edge of the known world. I was writing short stories even back then, but they were terrible, and I wasn't to become a published writer for almost 20 years at that point. First, I had to live a little, grow up as much as I could, and somehow find my place in the world. I had to go through being a student, a physicist, an engineer, a drummer, and a journalist before I eventually somehow stumbled into my calling as a writer. My first novel, Tombstoning, was published in 2006. By that time, I'd spent as long living in Edinburgh as I had in Arbroath, but it's interesting to note that the book was set almost entirely in Arbroath, only briefly flirting with Edinburgh in a few short scenes. Similarly, my next book, The Ossians, began and ended in the capital, but was set mostly in the Scottish Highlands, accompanying an unsigned rock band as they fell apart on tour. and that tendency emerged again with my third novel, Smokeheads. All the main characters were from Edinburgh, yet all the action took place on the remote whisky-producing island of Islay. It's almost as if I couldn't bring myself to look directly at the place, to bring it to life. By that time, I'd obviously read much more widely than I had as a teenager, so I was even more aware of Edinburgh as a literary city. Indeed, 2 years before my first book came out, Edinburgh was the first place in the world to be awarded the prestigious UNESCO City of Literature status. It is a place that is steeped in fiction, from the Scott Monument on Prince's Street, the largest monument to a writer in the world, to the Writers' Museum nestled away down a Vennel off the Royal Mile. And fictional depictions of Edinburgh are everywhere, from classics by Walter Scott, Robert Louis Stevenson and James Hogg, to the modern crime fiction of Ian Rankin and Val McDermott. From the acerbic observations of Muriel Spark to the cosy familiarity of Alexander McCall Smith to the scathing social commentary of Irvine Welsh. You can now go on literary pub tours of the city, drink in Inspector Rebus's Oxford Bar, or visit the dives that feature in Trainspotting. How can I contribute anything worthwhile in the face of all that? But very gradually, as I continued writing, I began to see that I might have a way in. I began to realise that everyone's version of a city is different from everyone else's, coloured as it is by our own personal experiences. And all of them are just as valid as each other. My version of Edinburgh is different from Ian Rankin's, it's different from Muriel Spark's, and it's certainly different from Alexander McCall Smith's Edinburgh. So why not write about it? Why not put my version on the page? My first attempt to write directly about Edinburgh was abortive. I spent 18 months working on a long family saga of a novel set in Portobello, Edinburgh's seaside neighbourhood. It was frankly rubbish, and it remains unpublished in a drawer to this day. But it wasn't the depictions of Edinburgh that made it rank, rather the plotting and character, so I was at least a little bit encouraged that I could write about the city effectively. And that came to fruition with my next novel, Hit and Run. Set almost entirely in the shadow of Arthur's Seat and Salisbury Crags in Edinburgh's south side, the novel was a complex and brutal noir tale which, according to some very kind praise from readers, apparently managed to depict that particular part of Edinburgh with verve and veracity. The student pubs and scruffy flats I knew so well came to life on the page, and in the final scenes when the gorse bushes on Salisbury Crags catch fire, I hoped the readers could smell the acrid smoke in their nostrils. I was suitably heartened. My next two novels are both set in Edinburgh again. For Gone Again, I revisited Portobello in the wake of that unsuccessful and unpublished novel. The book opens and closes on Portobello Beach, one of my favourite places in the world, and I hope that every grain of sand comes alive for the reader. In The Dead Beat, I flirted around the eastern neighbourhoods of Durringston and Abbey Hill, venturing as far into town as the dramatic North Bridge in the centre of the city. But such excursions into the familiar parts of Edinburgh are very rare in my fiction, I now realise. The Edinburgh in my three novels is not the same city that the tourists see. It's not the castle in the Royal Mile, the sprawling old town or the multitude of venues during the festival in August every year. The Edinburgh in my books is a city of forgotten suburbs, cheap housing and student areas, the places people live when they can't afford to live any nearer to the centre. And this, I hope, is one of the elements that gives my version of Edinburgh its authenticity. Looking back over them, another thing I've noticed in my Edinburgh books is just how geographically limited they all are. In each of the three Edinburgh-based novels, almost all of the action takes place within a very restricted physical area, sometimes not much more than a square mile or two. I write psychological thrillers, and this close proximity of the action helps to increase the sense of claustrophobia that my characters are feeling. And it also helps get across the sense that these characters cannot escape the fate that the book has in store for them. Just as they can't seem to escape the physical confines of their neighbourhoods, so they can't escape the terrible things coming down the track at them. From my most recent two books, I have once more escaped Edinburgh for settings further afield, but now it feels more like taking a breather than avoiding what's right in front of me. My most recent sojourns to South Queensferry and the Orkney Islands have been fun, but I know I'll be back in Edinburgh soon. Indeed, my next novel revisits Edinburgh, but in very different form. Fault Lines is set in an alternate reality Scotland that is now a major earthquake and volcano zone. A new volcanic island has been born in the Firth of Forth, and the central character is a research student who lives by the beach in Joppa, who sees the island every day and who feels the ground beneath her feet shake as she tries to face everything that the story throws at her. It is set in Edinburgh, but a different, slightly askew version that I know for sure cannot possibly be the same as anyone else's. It seems I'm finally ready to embrace my home city as my own.
That was Doug Johnston. You can find out more about Kathleen Jones, Catherine O'Flynn and Doug Johnston on the RLF website. And that concludes episode 188, which was recorded and produced by the Writers Aloud team. Coming up in episode 189, non-fiction writer Rupert Christiansen speaks with Frances Burns about journalistic antecedents, career versus vocation, being a jobbing writer, and his memoir serendipitously inspired by Don Draper of Mad Men. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.